Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This week we begin a special series on the U.S. Constitution. We'll be highlighting a project launched by the Bill of Rights Institute titled Founders and the Constitution, in their own words, a two-volume collection of materials intended to add to our understanding of the remarkable stories and ideas of America's founders. This week we focus on the idea of federalism and the story of Elbridge Gerry. But first, Dan Roberts, in his weekly Moment in Time, offers us part one in his three-part series on the constitutional issues addressed in the Webster-Hayne debate on the floor of the Senate in 1830.
During early United States history, there was a running dispute over trade and tariffs. A congressional impasse over tariffs led to the famous Hayne-Webster debate.
A Moment in Time with Dan Roberts.
Often competing regions and political parties have sought advantage by manipulating the taxing power of the federal government, which alone can place a tax on imported goods. In the 1800s, northern states were often in favor of high tariffs on imported goods, particularly from England, because a big tax on imports meant the goods would cost a lot more than items made in the USA, thus protecting America's infant industry. The South, with very little manufacturing, wanted the lowest possible tariffs so that when Southerners went overseas to sell their cotton, tobacco, and grain, they would not face retaliatory tariffs imposed by foreign governments. Each region was out for its own best interest. In 1828, Congress passed the so-called Tariff of Abominations. It protected northern manufacturers, but was bad for the South. Southern congressmen began to look for allies in order to repeal this tariff. In 1829, Connecticut Senator Samuel Foote moved to cut back on the sale of federal land in the West. Southerners reached out to forge a coalition with Westerners who were irritated at this attempt to cut off the sales of cheap government land. In January 1830, Senator Robert Young Hayne of South Carolina kicked off the debate, but suddenly the listeners realized that Hayne had changed the subject. Instead, he began to talk about the Constitution and states' rights. He insisted that states could nullify federal laws. In response, Senator Daniel Webster rose to defend the idea of union. Next time, Hayne and Webster debate the Constitution at the University of Richmond. This is Dan Roberts.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, an article recently distributed by the Associated Press reminded readers that Washington, D.C. is much smaller today than it was originally envisioned, and as a result, a very different city than it might have become. As planned, the nation's capital was to be 100 square miles. If that were the case today, it would include the city of Alexandria and Arlington County, Virginia, and have a population of nearly 900,000 residents. Moreover, it might well have become a commercial trading center rivaling New York or Philadelphia. President George Washington, who lived nearby, advocated for the 100-square-mile plan and even personally positioned one of the cornerstones. He envisioned the city that would bear his name as the cultural and economic epicenter of the nation. But members of Congress with seaport constituencies opposed appropriating federal funds to build public wharves and other facilities that would have benefited the capital, and over the next few decades retroceded much of the land that was to be in the District of Columbia back to the state of Virginia. If that hadn't occurred, the district would be a fiscally more viable city and not as dependent on the federal government, commented Kenneth Bowling, a historian at George Washington University. The city's tax base would be larger and its population more diverse. This is Talking History. Founders and the Constitution, in their own words, published by the Bill of Rights Institute, includes 8 essays that explore central themes and ideas debated by the authors of the U.S. Constitution and Bill of Rights and that remain relevant today. One of those ideas is federalism, and here to discuss that topic with me is the author of the essay on federalism for the series, David Marion, Elliott Professor of Political Science at Hampton-Sydney College and Director of the Wilson Center for Leadership in the Public Interest. Welcome, David.
Pleasure to be with you, Brian.
Let's begin by having you define federalism.
Brian, a federal system is one that divides power among several units within a single political system. That would be in contrast to a unitary or centralized political order where you had all of the undivided authority lodged in one place.
So the idea here is, I suppose, you have to make a decision to move one way or the other, either to break down, if you will, the silos of these individual units and go for the larger unit, or to keep the power at the more local level.
That's correct. There are two major structural dimensions to the political system that the founders gave us. Federalism represents one of those features, the division of power among different governmental units. The other is separation of powers, which involves the division of power within each of the different units.
Right. Both intended for different purposes, I understand.
That's correct.
Okay. Let me take you back historically here, because in your essay, I think you make a very good point right at the start, where you write that history and theory seem to be on the side of a confederation of small American republics or states in the 1780s. And in fact, that was reflected in what we often refer to as our first Constitution, the Articles of Confederation. Explain that a bit.
Well, you know, we often forget that we had been around for a long time before we declared our independence, and the American people were accustomed from the early 1600s to the 1770s, 1780s, to being governed by officials within their own colonies, and then within the independent states after we had declared our independence. So on the one hand, there was that familiarity with colonial or state control of the affairs of the people. On the other hand, they were also familiar with a body of thought associated with theorists like Jean-Jacques Rousseau that held that republican government requires a citizenry that possesses certain virtues or habits. And those habits or virtues can only be cultivated in small political communities. You can't get them in places as big as China. You got to get them in places the size of Rhode Island or Delaware or New Jersey.
So out of practical experience and out of the dominant thought of the day, one would expect them to lean in the direction of Confederation. And how was that reflected in the Articles of Confederation?
I'm going to actually back up just a little bit and then move to the Articles. We see it in the Declaration of Independence, for example. The Declaration pointed us in the direction of the Articles of Confederation right in 1776. At the end of the Declaration, we have the Americans saying that power now should be lodged with these states that should have the authority to declare war, make peace, engage in treaty making, do all of the things the Declaration said that nation states as of right ought to be able to do. So the Declaration itself pointed us in the direction of what we ended up with at first, these Articles of Confederation that affirm the principle of state sovereignty. The Articles really created something like a league, an alliance system of these 13 states that retained their power to manage their own domestic affairs or internal affairs, but understood they probably needed to come together for purposes of defense, foreign policy, a few things like that.
So what caused them to change their mind? Why did they move away from that in time?
What happened was that perceptive Americans like Washington, like Madison, like Hamilton, recognized that we were not positioning ourselves well with the Articles, with this governmental system, to get the benefits out of independence that we were looking for. You know, it's sometimes said that we're a Lockean regime or we were a Lockean people in the 1760s, 1770s, and 1780s. And what's meant by that is that we subscribed to Locke's belief that legitimate government is government based on the consent of the people and government that protects the rights of the people and promotes the safety and happiness of the people. Well, if you put those two words together, safety and happiness, what do they add up to? Well, they add up to something like comfortable preservation. And so Madison and Washington and Hamilton and others saw that we weren't producing those results. The infighting that was going on, the competition between the states was making it difficult for us, for instance, to have a strong interstate commerce system. And without a strong interstate commerce system, you weren't going to have comfortable preservation.
Can you take that just a step further and be a little bit more specific about things that just weren't working in the Articles of Confederation?
For example, Congress could ask the states to cooperate when things needed to be done to benefit the whole Union, but the states didn't have to go along. They didn't have to cooperate. The central government did not have a court system that it could use, something analogous to our federal judiciary today, to enforce its will on the states, to compel them to do certain things, to go along. And, of course, allied with this frustration were these incidents going on in the states like Massachusetts, Shays Rebellion, and the perceived inability of the states to maintain order and to see to the proper administration of justice within their own boundaries. Madison, in his famous Federalist Paper 10, alludes to this. He says, you know, why is it that we got the Constitutional Convention? Why is it that we ended up with this new constitutional arrangement that we're now debating? It's because the states were not up to the job of ensuring, he says, the steady administration of justice within their boundaries. And so rights were not secure. Liberty was not secure. And if we had declared our independence for anything, it was to see that our rights indeed were secure and that we enjoyed our liberties.
Okay, good. Good point, and that provides the transition for us here to move to Philadelphia in the writing of the Constitution. Let's take it up with the guy that's often referred to as the father of the U.S. Constitution, James Madison. He comes in with a plan almost immediately. Tell us about that.
That's right. Madison understands that we are on the edge of the precipice, that this is a critical moment. He does his homework. He produces two documents in the months preceding the convention. One, a history of confederations. He had asked Jefferson, who was in Europe, to send him books on historical confederations. He studies them, and he produces this memorandum that he takes with him to Philadelphia with particulars on what happened to the Belgic Confederation, to ancient Greek confederations, to Germanic confederations, and he's able to refer to that document at the convention. The other thing that he works on is something that comes to be known as the Virginia Plan, and it really is the outline, the sketch for a new national system of government, not merely a confederation, but a national system this time.
Can you give me a couple examples of what was included in that plan?
Yes. Unlike the Articles, Madison's Virginia Plan provided for a separate legislative department, separate executive department, and separate judicial department. Now, if you're a good Lockean, you're going to see what's going on immediately. With the Articles of Confederation, they had not given much power to the central government. Well, if you're not giving much power to the central government, you don't have to worry about governmental tyranny. If you don't have to worry about governmental tyranny, you don't have to worry about breaking up the power that the government has. The fact that Madison, in this plan, was talking about separate legislative, executive, and judicial branches was a tip right there that he planned to give this government some real power, and therefore we needed to break it up among departments that could check and balance each other. Congress under the Virginia Plan, for example, would be in a position to nullify acts of the states that were not consistent with the new constitutional system. The central government would have the power to manage interstate commerce. So there were several things in there that tipped us off to the fact that this was really going to be a national type of government and not a mere confederation.
Okay. From 21st century historical hindsight, all this seems pretty obvious, but he had his opponents then, and one of them was Roger Sherman. And what was Roger upset about?
Roger Sherman was someone who believed that you could only preserve liberty and rights in small republics. And he comes into the convention and is prepared to argue that the Articles need to be tweaked. They need perhaps to be reformed a bit, but they don't need to be scrapped. And so he then takes on Madison and the other proponents of a national government, saying that all they need is a central government that will manage foreign policy, trade, and defense, leaving all other matters to the states. And he says on June 6, the people are happier in the states than they would be in a large national system. Madison's got to defeat him on June 6. He can't let him win that argument. And what Madison responds with is an argument based on an appeal, again, to rights and liberty. He looks at the delegates and he says, why are we here? Aren't we here because we aren't satisfied with the way in which the states are protecting the rights of the people or the liberties of the people or advancing comfortable preservation? Isn't that the issue? Now, how can we best promote those ends? And his response is with a large republic. Let's go with a large republic and a multiplicity of interests. We're going to then put ourselves in a position to deal with this problem of factious violence that we're seeing in the states, and we're going to position ourselves to really promote the comfortable preservation of the people.
Well, he carries the day, and we do end up with a federal system, or certainly a more federal system than we had before we went to Philadelphia. But some compromises were included along the way, and although we talked about some of the major points of Madison's plan, would you like to go back to that plan or the final product and talk again just a little bit more about how this was a federal system ultimately?
It is a federal system insofar as it divides governing authority between a national government and these independent states, but not sovereign states. The real big distinction between Madison's federal system and the quintessential classical federal system is that the old federal systems or confederal systems preserve the sovereignty of the states. Madison's doesn't. But Madison recognizes that there's good that can come out of preserving the states as important political units in this constitutional system. He sees that they can be doing some very good things for the people and for the country. And so he calls what we end up with in the Federalist Papers a compound republic with some national features and some federal features. And the federal features aren't there just because we're compromising. We had to give in. They're sort of necessary evils in order to get some kind of a national system. But Madison will concede that those federal elements are good overall for the people and for the constitutional order. An example of a national element to the system, the fact that the House of Representatives is made up of representatives who are apportioned based on population and not on mere equality, so that Pennsylvania will end up with more representatives in the House of Representatives than, say, a Delaware or a Rhode Island. That's based on the national principle. Congress's control of interstate commerce, again, evidence that this is to be a national government. Federal or confederal element, the equal representation of the states in the Senate. The Electoral College system that counts votes within the states, federal elements, and again, Madison sees that these federal elements can be beneficial.
Well, we're almost out of time. Let me just ask you one last quick question to end it all, and that is that it gets even more complicated when a Bill of Rights is eventually adopted as the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, and the 10th Amendment is often referred to as a states' rights amendment. Now, very briefly, how do we work that into this whole conversation?
Again, it is a recognition of the fact that the states are important entities in this constitutional system. The Bill of Rights, of course, is the product of a compromise. The proposal had been made at the Constitutional Convention, was not adopted then, but later concessions are made. We will add the Bill of Rights in 1791. It's debated in Congress in 1789. The first 8 of those amendments protect rights. The 9th says we might have missed some rights, but that doesn't mean other things aren't protected as well. And then we get this states' rights amendment that says that if the powers not given to the national government are not denied to the states, are reserved to the states respectively and to the people. A recognition that the states are going to be important. Now, also a recognition that we've got a built-in tension in this constitutional system. We're eventually going to get a civil war out of this tension. And the tension is still with us today. But the attention does not need to be a destructive attention. And I would argue that overall, if we look at this historically, the tension has been constructive or beneficial for the Republic.
Great. Okay. And that's where we'll end it, on that very good point. So thank you, David, for being with us.
Pleasure to be with you, Brian.
You've been listening to David Marion, Elliott Professor of Political Science at Hampton-Sydney College and Director of the Wilson Center for Leadership in the Public Interest. He's also the author of the essay on federalism that is included in the Founders and the Constitution series. This is Talking History. Founders and the Constitution, in their own words, includes 24 units, each dedicated to a specific founder. Our guest this week, David Marion, prepared the following brief introduction to Elbridge Gerry.
Elbridge Gerry is remembered today for his controversial attempt as governor of Massachusetts to draw controversial districts to the advantage of his party. Indeed, gerrymandering is a common political tactic today and undeniably part of Gerry's legacy. But Gerry was more than a shrewd politician. He was also a leader of the American independence movement, an important critic of the Constitution, and a wartime vice president of the United States. The son of a wealthy shipping magnate, Gerry saw firsthand how British economic policy hurt American merchants. By 1774, he became convinced that the colonies needed to join together to form an independent nation. Gerry was selected to attend the Continental Congress in 1775. There he worked tirelessly to convince others to support the independence movement. In the process, he won the respect of fellow delegates, but Gerry could be stubborn and difficult, and his unpredictable nature often frustrated even his allies. Chosen as a delegate to the Constitutional Convention, Gerry at first adopted a moderate stance between nationalists, who favored a strong central government, and states' rights advocates. He chaired the committee that forged the Great Compromise. This agreement provided for equal representation of the states in the Senate and proportional representation in the House of Representatives. But Gerry again was combative, and in the words of a fellow delegate, objected to everything he did not propose. Gerry feared that the central government set up by the Constitution would be too powerful and a threat to the rights of the people. He was one of three delegates who stayed to the end of the convention, but who refused to sign the Constitution. Once the document was ratified, however, Gerry accepted a seat in the new Congress and even began to sympathize with the Federalist Party, which favored a strong central government. But after being criticized by the Federalists for his role in the XYZ affair that strained the relationship between France and the United States during the administration of John Adams, Gerry embraced the rival Democratic Republicans, the party of Thomas Jefferson. As a member of this party, Gerry served as governor of Massachusetts and as vice president under James Madison during the War of 1812. He died while serving in the latter office, a public servant to the end of his life.
You've been listening to David Marion, Elliott Professor of Political Science at Hampton-Sydney College and Director of the Wilson Center for Leadership in the Public Interest. And finally, for our site of the week, Talking History's Fiona Beatty reports on a wonderful new center where you can learn much more about the United States Constitution and enjoy yourself in the process.
Standing on Independence Mall, Philadelphia, the state-of-the-art National Constitution Center offers eye-pleasing contours and invites curiosity. The entrance in Grand Hall welcomes the visitor with a colorful array of the flags of the 50 states. In the Kimmel Theater, an orientation film and a live actor set the scene describing the role of the center, 1787, the Constitution, its major themes and relevance today. The American Experience exhibit in DeVos Hall offers adults and children many choices of interactive multimedia exhibits, and one is surrounded by the Constitution, its words etched in 450 feet of illuminated glass spanning the walls. And there is more. The lifelike bronze figures of the framers in Signers Hall make it easy to step back in time to September the 17th, 1787. The meaning of the Constitution is brought to life in the American Tree exhibit, where the display focuses on the lives of 100 Americans and their role in the Constitution. And visitors can attend any of the many debates, lectures, and special events offered by the Annenberg Center for Education and Outreach. There is much to do at the National Constitution Center. To plan your visit, or just to get more information, check out the website at www.constitutioncenter.org.
That's it for another week of Talking History. We hope you enjoyed the program. For more information on founders and the Constitution in their own words, as well as valuable collections of related materials, video clips, founding documents, lesson plans for teachers, and more, visit the Bill of Rights Institute website at www.billofrightsinstitute.org. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, Fiona Beatty, producer, Alex Smith, our studio engineer. The opinions offered by our guests on Talking History, however, do not necessarily reflect those of the program staff or of the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. A Moment in Time is produced by Dan Roberts and distributed by WCVE-FM in Richmond, Virginia. For more information, visit amomentintime.com. And finally, as always, we welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to talkinghistory@umkc.edu or send them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.